Comrade Chairman and comrades, first an explanation and an apology. When I was first approached with the proposal that I give a series of lectures on the international, I thought that the subject could be encompassed within a series of three lectures. I found, however, that I had bitten off a bit more than I could masticate in three lectures. And now I hope to be able to do it in six, but three will have to be postponed to a later date. So we'll go as far as we can in these three and then take up the other development sometime later. Now, we attach great importance to studying the lessons of the past, both the victories and defeats of the working class movement on a world scale. In this, we differ with the spokesmen and pundits of the New Left, whose tendency is to deny that we have any lessons to learn from the past, and who reject past experience as, if you'll excuse the expression, borrowed from the New Left, irrelevant. I guess it's inevitable in a movement of this kind, which is a very primitive one, very confused and groping, and one that takes place in a period where the working class itself is relatively quiescent, apathetic. The New Left really begins to date history some 10 years ago with the in the aftermath of the Khrushchev 20th Congress de-Stalinization speech. It was this process of de-Stalinization, together with the revolution in Hungary and the Poznan uprising, that led a whole section of the intellectuals, primarily in the Communist Party in Britain, to break with the CP and to begin the search for something new to replace what they had considered Marxism, the kind of Marxism they learned in the Stalinist movement. As you recall, the movement began with the publication of a magazine called the New Left Review in Britain, together with a magazine called Universities and something else, I can't recall the title offhand. And from Britain, it came over to this country, primarily through the writings of C. Wright Mills. C. Wright Mills cooperated and collaborated with the New Lefters in Britain, and then later became one of the main ideologues of the same tendency that developed here. And that's characteristic of the so-called New Left, is to tend to identify what they call the old left with the Communist Party. Many times you don't know what they're talking about. They sort of lump everything together and throw it all into one pot, designated all as the New Left, but in the main, it really was a rejection of Stalinism and the Stalinist version of Marxism. after the very bad experiences that they went through in that movement. In this country, probably one of the foremost ideological currents of the New Left are organized around studies on the left. And there, if you've been following that magazine and their views, they've been grappling with problems that they consider to be very new. And of course, they're not new at all. Most of them are as hoary as Methuselah. One of the problems is the question of the agency of social change. What is going to be the agency of social change in this country and in the other advanced capitalist countries? They reject the working class as the primary agency of social change, and so they cast about to find some substitute, some new elite, some social formation that will take the place of the working class. On the question of the party, they reject Leninism, that is the concept of the combat party, and democratic centralism. And they yearn for a return to the good old days of the Deb Socialist Party. Never having been in the party, they can, of course, speak freely about what, and very learnedly, about what the Deb Socialist Party was and is. They projected the idea of establishing what they call a revolutionary center. I know that was one of the debates carried on in their magazine. And the revolutionary center, presumably, would be that medium through which the new lefters would gradually coalesce and would lead to the formation of some kind of a political party. I remember an article by Stanley Aronowitz, one of the editors of the New Left, who discovered the virtues of the concept of the all-inclusive party, which again is nothing very new. We went through that experience 30 years ago with the Socialist Party, when we entered the Socialist Party. At that time, on the basis of this concept of the all-inclusive party. Now, I happen to be acquainted with the old Socialist Party of the Debs days, which was not a Debs party by any manner of means, although Debs is the most prominent spokesman of it, and of the all-inclusive party also. And if you want a very lively discussion circle, that would be a good direction to look. Providing you weren't serious about your ideas, and providing your perspective was not that of making a social revolution. In the so-called Deb Socialist Party, it reminds me of nothing more than the very divergent, heterogeneous, hostile and antagonistic currents which are present today in the New Left. At that time, they were all in the Socialist Party. Every rebel, everyone who rebelled against capitalism, found a place in the Socialist Party. And that included Christian socialists, pacifists, free love cultists, vegetarians, professional Christ killers, atheists, reformists of every variety, along with left-wing socialists, revolutionary socialists, constituted the left wing. The party was then very democratic, especially very tolerant of extreme right-wing views, not so democratic with the left wing, however. They had what they called state autonomy, Each state was autonomous. Newspapers were not published by the Socialist Party, were not under the control of the party leadership or the party membership. Usually they were privately published and privately owned. Even the biggest mass circulation papers. And at the very first crisis, that is the war, and even more so, with the October Revolution, why the organization just split wide open, not only in one part, but in a dozen different parts. And to yearn for a return to those days is like trying to, some people that yearn for a return to the good old days of the town hall meeting, where everything was resolved by an assembly of citizens getting together and engaging in participatory democracy, which may have been very good form that developed after the Revolutionary War, but is a little dated. Many things have happened. And so you find a impatience on their part, especially with the Trotskyists, who insist upon studying history and Marxism and trying to derive from such a study lessons which are applicable today. It's not just an abstract study. To learn from the defeats and victories and to apply those lessons in the current struggle. The Revolutionary Party, our party, and our international, is, in this sense, the memory of the working class. And the parties of reformism, you can say, and of Stalinist revisionism are notoriously the parties of poor memory. Not only would they like to forget, they would like everybody else to forget their history, their development, and the source of their current policy, which is rooted in the past. And while it takes different forms, there's no essential difference today over the general thrust of their policy than what was true some years ago, a policy that led to a whole series of defeats. Now, I understand along with this lecture, Comrade Novak is going to lecture on the First and Second International. I don't know whether he's coming here, but you'll probably get the tapes. And there will probably be a more extensive series on the Third International and then on the Fourth International, where I hope to take up where this series leaves off. Now, for the first 10 years of the Trotskyist existence, that is from 1923 to 1933, the Trotskyist Left Opposition functioned as a faction of the Communist International. The struggle broke out in the Soviet Union, over the whole question of perspective of the revolutionary development, both in the Soviet Union and on a world scale. The left opposition, that is the Moscow opposition, led by Trotsky, then later merged with what was known as the Leningrad opposition, led by Zinoviev and Kamenev, to found the United Left Opposition, which published its program, and the program was published in English in a translation by Max Eastman in a volume called The Real Situation in Russia. That was the program of the United Left Opposition. For with the victory of Hitler in Germany, Trotsky concluded that the Third International, as a common term, was dead. It was no longer a viable instrument for revolutionary change, and called for the formation of the Fourth International. Just as Lenin did in 1914, when the Second International, corroded by opportunism, joined, the various sections joined with their own bourgeoisie in supporting the war, Lenin said that the Second International was dead as a viable instrument of revolutionary change and called for the formation of a Third International. That was as long ago as 1914, 1915, early part of 1915. It then took some 5 years, from 1933 to 1938, before the actual founding Congress of the Fourth International was held, which adopted the transitional program. Now, from the very beginning, from the time that the Americans made contact with Trotsky's ideas in 1928, the American Party played a leading and, it would be true to say, a decisive role in the development and extension of the International Communist League, which was the Trotskyist world tendency, and established the Communist League of America in this country as the Trotskyist tendency of the Americans. You're all acquainted how this occurred, that at the Sixth World Congress, comrades Cannon and his Canadian comrade, what is his name? Spector, got hold of Trotsky's criticism of the draft program, were able to smuggle it out of Russia. And on that basis began a struggle inside of the Canadian Party and in the American Party for the ideas expressed in this platform, asking only for the right to hold such a discussion at periods set aside by the party for this purpose, in pre-convention periods, but were summarily expelled. And it's true to say that from that day forward, the American Party has been one of the mainstays of the Fourth International, despite the fact that in 1940 we had to formally disaffiliate because of the reactionary Voorhees Act, which made affiliation with an international organization a crime. Nevertheless, although formally severing our organizational affiliation, we played a very active role in the ideological struggles, in the leadership, in the organizational support, and in the help and participation of the Americans in all of the development of the Fourth International. Now, there is not, you see, up to the time of the First World War, the Fourth International didn't have much of an actual history as an organization. It was founded in 1938, 1939, war broke out. And the comrades in Europe, some of them were lucky enough to get out. Some of them were thrown into Hitler's concentration camps, some into Stalin's. Some assassinated, murdered, and let's say a few who were able to escape to exile. So for the whole period of the war, the actual material apparatus of the Fourth International existed here in this country. The Americans took primary responsibility for keeping the International alive in that very difficult period. And then it was after the end of the war in 1945, it was reestablished in Europe again in 1946. And that's really when the development of the Fourth International as an organization begins. The great contribution of the founding Congress was the adoption of the program called the Transition Program, the Death Agony of Capitalism, the TAS of the Fourth International. Now, as I stated before, the origin of the left opposition in the Soviet Union stemmed from the differences that developed over the whole question of strategy, tactics, and program for the world revolution and for the development inside the Soviet Union. The Bolshevik Party and its entire leadership, and this there was no exceptions, at the time of the October Revolution considered that the revolution in Russia was the beginning, not the end, the beginning of the world revolution. From the very moment of its success, the establishment of the Soviet power, the leaders looked to the West, to one of the advanced capitalist countries of Europe, to come to the assistance of the more backward country of Russia, which was one of the most backward countries in Europe. When the revolutions failed to materialize, that is, the successful carrying through of the revolutions, there were no lack of revolutionary developments. What there was a decided lack of revolutionary victories outside of the Soviet Union. The revolutionary wave receded after 1920. And they were defeated primarily because in no country in Europe did the left wing of the Second International, and all the socialist tendencies were affiliated with the Second International, including the Bolsheviks, did they succeed in building the kind of a party which was necessary to lead a successful revolution. This was Lenin's unique contribution, the concept of the combat party, of these strongly disciplined party, and the concept of the necessity of party leadership, both of the party leading the class leading the mass, and of leadership within the party, that constitutes his, as I say, his unique and one of his greatest contributions to the art of revolutionary struggle. Trotsky became a Leninist on this question. He wasn't always a supporter of Lenin's views on the party. In fact, they were in opposing factions for a great part of their adult political lives. And it was only at the time of the revolution in 1917 that Trotsky acknowledged Lenin's priority on this question and accepted his leadership and became, as he called it, one of Lenin's pupils. Just as Cannon, in turn, became a pupil of Trotsky on this and on the political questions, and we are all pupils of Cannon, Trotsky, and Lenin. The defeats in Europe due to the lack of a Bolshevik party inevitably led to a spread of ultra-leftism, adventurism, putschism, attempts to substitute the mass, substitute the party for the class, and those of you who have read Lenin's Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder will remember how he polemicized against the ultra-leftism of these young formations. Without exception, the communist parties in Europe developed out of splits in the social democracy, in social democratic parties. Now, it's true that Lenin's party also was a faction of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, but it was more than that. From 1903, actually, this faction, the faction of the Bolsheviks, existed and functioned like a party. They were a party, although, as I say, considered themselves part of the international movement. This experience was not duplicated anywhere else. In the most promising section, the German section, the outstanding leaders of the left wing, Luxemburg and Liebknecht, rejected Lenin's concept of party building. And as a result, the creation of the party was so long delayed and came so late that the revolution was turned back and defeated, and Luxemburg and Liebknecht were assassinated. The first Congress of the Communist International in 1919 actually was attended by very few representatives, authentic representatives of organizations in Europe. Remember, 1919, Russia was then under blockade. The armies of imperialism had troops on Russian soil. Civil war raged on 21 fronts. It was very difficult for representatives to get into Russia, especially those in applying for visas to attend the founding Congress of the Third International. The Bolsheviks felt it was absolutely essential that they proceed with the proclamation, not only the proclamation of the necessity, but the actual organization of the Third International, because, for one thing, the representatives of the Second, the Yellow International, immediately following the war, attempted to reconstitute the Second International on the basis of the call for unity of the social democracy. In order to hit off this development and to indicate that that unity was of the type practiced by the right-wing social democrats, was unity with the capitalist class against the workers, the First International was proclaimed, the Third International was proclaimed, the organization meeting was set. The organization meeting resulted in the formation of the International and the adoption of a statement of principles. I have a picture on the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Third International. The Communist International, that was the magazine of the Comintern, published what do they call 10th anniversary? Centennial? No, what is the 10th? Huh? Well, whatever it is. A special edition. And in it they have photographs of the meeting of the First International, of the First Congress, of the Second Congress, and of the Third Congress. Well, the picture of the first Congress of the Third International, the hall was maybe half the size of this hall, and the congregation was less than what of what we have here in this room today. These were the pioneers who set out at that time to establish the Third International to overthrow world capitalism. That was their object and that was their aim. In 1920, Lenin wrote Left-Wing Communism, an Infantile Disorder, against these ultra-leftist and putschist and adventurous tendencies. And the Second World Congress in 1920 had for its purpose a clear demarcation and differentiation in the world socialist movement. It was at this Congress, the second, that they laid down the 21 conditions for affiliation. The object of the 21 conditions for affiliation was to separate the parties of the Third International from any organizational connection with those elements that still clung to the Second International or centrist elements that oscillated between the Second and the Third International. They set down such conditions as to make it impossible for the opportunists who remained within the parties of the Second International to affiliate to the Third International. You had the big Italian party, for example, the Turati wing, which was the extreme right wing, coexisted with the left wing in one party. Turati carrying on his opportunist line, an extension of the kind of a line that he developed, carried through during the war, and the left wing that opposed the war and supported the Bolshevik. Lenin had to not only point out this was an error, that you could never build a homogeneous combat party designed for the specific purpose of leading a struggle for the conquest of power on the part of that kind of a heterogeneous and antagonistic composition, and the 21 points were intended to end this sort of ambiguity which existed in parties requesting affiliation to the Third International. You remember that during this time there was a great revolutionary upsurge throughout the whole of Europe. The Norwegian Labour Party as a whole applied for affiliation to the Third International. The whole Italian party applied for affiliation. Parties and leaders who had become discredited during the war sought the cover of the Third International in order to re-establish their own prestige with the revolutionary mood and movement of the workers in this country. And Lenin was astute enough and shrewd enough to see what they were after and submitted these 21 conditions. So you agree what these conditions are, you cannot affiliate with the International. And this split the movement wide open throughout the entire world. The Social Democratic Party split into the Communist parties and the Socialist parties. And a split that took the form of an attempt on the part of the centrists to establish what they call the 2.5 International in between the Third International and the Second International. The Third International was red. That was the Red International. The Second International was designated as the Yellow International. They had betrayed the workers in the First World War. And the 2.5 International, I suppose you could designate as the pinks, in between the reds and the yellows. They didn't last very long. The centrist formation that soon disappeared from the scene, but under the pressure of the left-wing movement of the masses, took a half step towards the Third International. Now, with the receding of the revolutionary wave, and the realistic appraisal of the development in Europe, in which the communist parties were, in most cases, a minority of the working class parties, Lenin and Trotsky united in the Third World Congress in a struggle against the lefts. And they did it ostentatiously by proclaiming themselves as adherents of the right wing. They both said, we are right wing on this question of the necessity of conquering the masses before engaging in the conquest of power. You have to have attain the leadership of the majority of the working class, which in turn will draw the, at least a significant section of the petty bourgeois peasants behind them before you can engage realistically in the struggle for power. And that the task of the communist parties then was to win the masses before engaging in the direct struggle for workers' power. There was a left wing at that time, representatives of the various parties, and in the Soviet Union, consisting of Bukharin and Radek, who led the left wing. They fought it out, and Lenin and Trotsky emerged victorious. By the way, the original proclamation for the first Congress, calling for the first Congress of the Third International, were signed by Lenin and Trotsky, who were the most authoritative and best-known spokesman of the Bolshevik Party. The Third World Congress in 1921 elaborated the tactic of the United Front. The tactic of the United Front was designed specifically to cope with this problem of working class divided between the Social Democrats on the one hand, Communist Party on the other, centrists in between. In order to unite the workers, first in action for defense of their immediate interests, and second, that in the process of the struggle itself, to enable the workers through action to confirm what the Bolsheviks had been saying and continue to say about the betrayals of their leadership. Pointed out, it wasn't enough just to publish articles in magazines, newspapers, and books. The workers don't learn primarily from reading. They learn primarily through action, through their own experience, in struggle. And it was this particular problem that the tactic of the United Front was devised to solve. After the Third World Congress, Lenin was taken ill, and from that time we can date the beginning of the development of the bureaucratic caste in the Soviet Union on the basis of the defeats in Europe, on the tiredness of the mass that had gone through several years of civil war, the destruction of the economy, loss of faith or hope, at least in the immediacy of an extension of the revolution to the advanced countries which would come to the aid of the Soviet Union, there developed the struggle over the division of the products of Soviet industry and agriculture and the establishment of the bureaucracy. It was on this basis, and especially after the German defeat of 1923, that the bureaucratization became accelerated, and out of this development arose for the first time the promulgation of the theory of building socialism in a single country. Now, the German defeat of 1923 was the direct responsibility of the Communist International, which had intervened. It was then under the leadership of Zinoviev, who, together with Kamenev, established Kamenev and Stalin established what was called the Troika, the triumvirate that led the Russian party for this whole period. Zinoviev and Stalin advised the German party against undertaking a struggle for power when conditions had matured. Remember, this is the period when the French occupied the Ruhr, when there was a tremendous social crisis, when workers were abandoning the social democracy and coming over to the Communist Party, when it looked as though, and everybody was convinced, that the Communist Party really had a majority of the working class supporting it. They hesitated, withdrew under pressure of the Communist International, became overly cautious, and missed the opportunity to lead a successful overturn in Germany. This further confirmed the prognosis of the Stalin faction and the triumvirate that the revolution was not in the cards in Europe, and strengthened the more conservative tendencies within the Soviet Union. Now, in the ideological sphere, the attack of the triumvirate against Trotsky took the form of an attack upon the theory of permanent revolution. Seems rather odd, but they published a pamphlet which is translated in English called Leninism or Trotskyism by G. E. Zinoviev, I. Stalin, and L. Kamenev. This was published about 1924, I think, 25, in this country. It has an article by each one in which the theory of the permanent revolution becomes a center and focus of their attack on what they designated as Trotskyism. Now, it's true that this material was circulated, but not Trotsky's views. The bureaucratization in the Comintern had reached the point where the views of the official spokesman for the ruling group were circulated, not only circulated, but parties and the leadership of parties were lined up on threat of being expelled unless they supported the majority faction. But nothing of Trotsky's views was permitted to circulate throughout the various sections of the Comintern. It's something similar to what is taking place today in China, for example. And this is nothing new. What's taking place in China today is a repetition of the so-called Hundred Flowers campaign, which was followed by the big campaign against the rightists. That is, you never hear the views of the opposition. You never hear stated what it is they stood for. What was their program? What were their views? What were their policies that warrant the their stigmatization as, what, how do they stigmatize them now, as monsters, as ogres, and so forth and so on. That's all you get, is the official version. You don't even get a version of what their views are. All you get they're stigmatized as counter-revolutionary, as seeking the restoration of capitalism, and so forth and so forth and so on, without any idea of what they stand for. The same sort of thing took place at that time. That is, a worldwide campaign against Trotskyism and the theory of the permanent revolution, without Trotsky even being permitted, or the left opposition being permitted, to have its views circulated in the sections affiliated to the Communist International. Now, the theory of the permanent revolution, actually, the course of the development of the revolution in Russia followed the perspective of development outlined in Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution. This was confirmed by the development from February to October. And on this question, Trotsky was right as against Lenin. Although Lenin's formula of the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry, as Trotsky pointed out, was an algebraic formula. That is, it did not define in this two-class dictatorship what the relationship would be between the workers and the peasants. At one time, Lenin did not exclude that in the two-class dictatorship that the peasants would constitute a majority, that in the process of the democratic revolution, the democratic stage of the revolution, the peasants would organize their own political party and they would then be an absolute majority, overwhelming majority of the population in Russia at that time, or the peasants. But at any rate, it was this algebraic formula that was finally invested with a concreteness in the actual development of the revolution from February to October 1917, when it developed that it was only under the leadership of the working class, in alliance with the peasantry, under the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, that they were able to establish the dictatorship of the proletariat under the Soviet form, the Soviet system. Now, both Lenin and Trotsky consider this a dispute of the past. It wasn't customary in those days to hash over old disputes that had lost their significance. There were too many new problems and too many questions to be solved to indulge in that luxury. But this question, you will see later, played a very pernicious role when giving Lenin's formula an altogether different content than Lenin gave it. It led to the defeat in China when the Communist Party was subordinated to the Kuomintang in 1925-1927. Now, there was one qualification that Stalin attached to his theory of building socialism in a single country, and that is, if there was no foreign intervention, if there was no war. So from that time forward, the policy of the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union was directed at preventing the outbreak of war, of subordinating actual revolutionary developments in other countries that threatened the status quo and raised the danger of the possible intervention of imperialism in an attack on the Soviet Union. In the Chinese Revolution of 1925-27, Stalin's bureaucracy concocted the theory of the block of four classes. Designated the Kuomintang, the organization of Chiang Kai-shek, which conducted the war for the unification of China, as the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry. The Communist Party was sent into the Kuomintang, subordinated to the discipline of the Kuomintang. And when Chiang Kai-shek returned from his expedition to the north, opened up an attack on the Communist Party, slaughtered the workers of Shanghai and the other cities, and established the rule of the Chinese capitalists and landlords, which prevailed until 1949, until the expulsion of Chiang Kai-shek and his fleeing China to Formosa. when the split with Zinoviev and Kamenev occurred, the Stalin faction shifted to the right and entered into a bloc with the right wing of the Bolshevik Party, which at that time was led by Bukharin, who became head of the Communist International, by Rykov, who became the head of the Soviets, and by Tomsky, who was the head of the Soviet trade unions. And this rightward swing coincided with a period of stabilization in Europe and throughout the world following the revolutionary developments which culminated in the defeat of the German working class in 1923, where there was promulgated the idea first advanced by Bukharin that it was possible to complete socialism within the boundaries of the Soviet Union, even if we proceeded at a tortoise pace, snail's pace, so long as there was a monopoly of foreign trade, and so long as there was nationalization of industry and of the land, then the question of time was of no importance whatsoever, and they could proceed very slowly, very gradually, to complete the building of socialism in the USSR. This fantasy, this utopia, was rudely exploded when the richer peasants, rich and middle peasants, actually began a strike, a grain strike against the cities, because lack of industrial products from the cities, there was no, the products were not available in exchange for grain, and prices became very disparate for the limited number of industrial products to exchange for grain. The kulaks, or the rich and middle peasants, then began pressure to make contact with the world market, because they could get more for their grain on the world market than the fixed prices that existed within the Soviet Union. This immediately threatened the overthrow of the state, because the only thing that prevented the restoration of capitalism, especially at that time, was the monopoly of foreign trade that prevented cheaper capitalist commodities from being brought into the Soviet Union in exchange for the agricultural products of a predominantly agricultural economy. The Trotsky's opposition were the first to have raised the necessity for a planned industrialization. They were stigmatized then as ultra-leftists for even proposing that that would be the only way to prevent what developed, that is, what they call the scissors, that opening, increasing disparity between the cost of industrial products and of agricultural products, the exchange between the village and the city. The conflict in the countryside became so acute, just prior to the Sixth World Congress, which was scheduled to convene in 1928. And a rift developed between the Stalin faction and the right wing, that is, Bukharin, Tomsky, and Rykov, although it was papered over at the Sixth World Congress, where they all appeared as a unified, in quotation marks, leadership. They denied that there was any friction in the leadership, and adopted the world program of the Communist International unanimously, naturally. Now, one manifestation of the bureaucratization of the Comintern was the growing infrequency of congresses. The First World Congress was held in 1919, the second in 1920, the third in 1921, yearly. The fourth was not held until No, the fourth was held in 1922. The fifth World Congress wasn't held until 1924. 2 years elapsed, and then 4 years elapsed between the fifth and the sixth World Congress in 1928. And then 7 years elapsed between the sixth and the seventh, which was the last World Congress held by the Comintern. It was at the sixth World Congress that Trotsky introduced his criticism of the draft program. Remember, up to this time, the Communist International had not adopted a program. Several drafts had been submitted and had been discussed at previous congresses, but they had not been completed. It was only at the sixth World Congress that they submitted jointly a program for the Communist International. And this program was an extremely eclectic one, based on which codified the concept of socialism in a single country and covered over the recent defeat suffered by the world working class in China through the victory of Chiang Kai-shek. And it was at the Sixth World Congress that our comrades got hold of the draft program and in which we date the origin of the organized Trotskyist movement on a world scale. It wasn't so long after the Sixth Congress that the rights were attacked as what? Bourgeois restorationists. That is Bukharin, Tomsky, and Rykov. And a fierce factional struggle broke out in which not only the Russian party, but the whole Comintern was purged. This had become a regular practice with every twist and turn in the policy. Not only would the leadership in the Soviet Union change, but the leaderships of the various sections would be ousted and others put in their place. The policy of scapegoatism. In Germany, there was Brandler, Thalheimer, and then they were ousted, and Maslow, Fischer. Here in this country, there was Foster. Then Lovestone, and then Browder, and so forth, and so on. Now, by 1928, there had already begun a change in the objective situation in Europe and in the United States. The beginnings of a economic depression and a change in the mood of the workers. Here, of course, the eruption came in 1929 with the stock market crash and then the long period of the depression. Within the Soviet Union, Stalin opened up his war against the kulaks, which up until that time had been encouraged to enrich themselves. He began the period of forced collectivization and the promulgation of the first of the five-year plans, forced industrialization, for which there was extracted a very heavy price on the Soviet economy. In retaliation, the peasants, the rich peasants, the middle peasants, slaughtered their cattle, destroyed crops, sabotaged agricultural production, brought the whole country to the verge of famine by their opposition to forced expropriation and then later forced collectivization. Hundreds of thousands were sent to concentration camps in Siberia, so forth and so on. It was on the background of this extreme left swing in the Soviet Union and the beginnings of a change in the economic situation in the West, that there was promulgated what has gone down in history as the third period, the policy, the tactics, and the strategy of third period Stalinism. Now, the third period was supposed to be the last period. That was the period in which capitalism was to be overthrown on a world scale. The final conflict was to take place within this so-called third period, and then the tactics were to be devised to fit in the framework of this so-called theoretical concept. It was in the third period that the theory of social fascism, which had previously been adumbrated but had never become ensconced as a practical, tactical measure, became fixed. Along with the theory of social fascism, they jettisoned the United Front concept as it was worked out by the Third World Congress and adopted what they call the United Front from below, as against the working within the existing trade union organizations. They split the reformist unions and established revolutionary trade unions, which in most instances were 100% revolutionary and 100% impotent, representing nothing but paper. Social fascism meant that the, Lenin had first coined these expressions, never social fascism, and they had some meaning. He characterized the social democrats as social imperialists, as social chauvinists, as social patriots, by which he meant that they were socialists in word and patriots in deed, or socialists in word and chauvinists in deed. Socialists were in word and supporters of their own imperialism in deed. But social fascism was absolutely meaningless. It was absolutely nonsensical, because the social democracy was as much threatened by fascism as was the Communist Party, the Communist Workers. Fascism, which aimed to destroy the independence of all working class organizations, and aimed immediately and directly at the organized working class, especially in their trade unions. So to designate the social democrats as social fascists was, as I say, not only meaningless but nonsensical, and led to all kinds of mischief. In fact, they said that the main enemy were not the fascists but the social fascists, because the base of the social fascists was in the working class. And in order to make the revolution, the Communist Party had to win over a majority of the working class. Therefore, because they constituted the main obstacle within the working class to winning over the majority to the Communist Party, they became the main enemy as against the fascists. The United Front from below was no United Front at all. The United Front concept, as it was developed by Lenin and Trotsky in the Third World Congress, meant that the organizations of the working class, both trade union and political, would enter into limited agreements with the top committees, beginning with the international and the national section, for united action on a specified with a specified program, with each organization retaining its independence and the full right of criticism. The object, as I explained before, was that in the process of these United Front actions, the Bolsheviks, Lenin and Trotsky and the others knew given the character of the leadership of the social democracy, that they would only be willing to go a certain point, to a certain point in the struggle. And so they were always insistent upon the right of criticism, that when the action had reached a certain point and the leaders of the social democracy tried to retreat, the Bolsheviks would carry on the struggle to its, hopefully to its conclusion, and win over, in the process of the struggle itself, the support of the workers formally adhering to the social democracy. Now, the formation of revolutionary trade unions, if you've read, I understand now one of their Bibles is left-wing communism. Now they like to quote left-wing communism because they've been on a right-wing binge for many years. Then you didn't hear much about left-wing communism because in left-wing communism, Lenin has a direct polemic against this concept. The concept was tried out here by the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. It proved to be, in practice, not only in theory, but in practice, it proved to be absolutely incapable of organizing and mobilizing the working class for effective social action. And for a very good reason. The trade union is the most elementary form of the United Fronts. In order to effectively organize a trade union, you've got to organize all the workers in the industry, regardless of what their religion is or what their degree of consciousness or any other differences that may separate them. The IWW would organize in action, and they led some very, very magnificent struggles. Would then give each of the workers a red card, and by virtue of that fact, they were in a revolutionary union. But that doesn't make a revolutionary out of a worker. They hand him a red card and say, now you're a member of a revolutionary organization. The trade union cannot substitute for the political party, which is homogeneous, which is based upon the most advanced, the most class-conscious workers, students, intellectuals, which is a selection, which is a voluntary organization, which has as its main objective is to conduct an offensive against the capitalist state and the capitalist parties. A trade union, by its very nature, is a defensive organization. The two, you cannot mix the two. But at any rate, they set out to form revolutionary trade unions. Now, if it was true that the third period was the last period, the collapse of capitalism and the beginning of the establishment of workers' states on a world scale, then you couldn't settle any strike because every strike was viewed as the beginning of the revolution, you see. It was not a strike for limited aims, that is for wages, hours, and working conditions, because you were in the third period, the revolutionary period, and your union was a revolutionary union, ostensibly organized to lead revolutionary actions against the state. So they couldn't settle a strike. The result was that in most cases, what few strikes they led ended in disaster. We'll go into that further tomorrow when we'll take up the difference between the United Front, the Popular Front, and other fronts of that we've seen in the past and that we're seeing today. Now, due to this policy, primarily this policy, the working class in Germany was split right down the middle. and Hitler marched to power without a struggle. It was the most disastrous kind of a defeat, comparable to the defeat recently in Indonesia, for example, where 300,000 communists were slaughtered by the military caste, by the reaction. There's no guarantee, you see, that workers engaged in action are going to win, or that a revolutionary party that leads workers in action are going to win. There are no such guarantees in advance. But if the class fights and is defeated in a struggle, what it retains is its great morale is sometimes heightened. There's no feeling of demoralization. The lessons are gathered, discussed, and absorbed. As the lessons of the 1905 revolution in Russia were a rehearsal for the 1917 revolution in October. And Lenin says, very frankly, he says, without 1905, although it resulted in a defeat, there could not have been October 1917. Without the rehearsal, and then the whole period of the re-examination of all these lessons in the from 1905 to 1917, there could not have been a successful revolution in Russia. But the most demoralizing kind of defeat, the most demoralizing, is a defeat that comes without a struggle, without making any attempt to fight back. That's why I'm not very optimistic when I hear these encouraging words in Peking Review about how this defeat is just a little temporary setback. No. No. Not any more than the defeat in Germany was a temporary setback. They're suffering right down to this very day for the policy of social fascism in Germany. Hitler marched to victory without a struggle. And remember, the German Communist Party was the biggest communist party outside of the Soviet Union in the period 1933. The Social Democratic Party was the biggest party in the Second International. Between the two of them, I think just prior to the time Hitler came to power, they got some 13 million votes in the election. A terrible catastrophe, not only for the German working class, but for the world working class. Because Trotsky warned that the victory of Hitler in Germany meant war, and that regardless of how the war began, the war at one stage or another of its development must be aimed at the Soviet Union. He even proposed, and for this he was called every kind of a fascist they could think of. He even proposed that the Red Army be mobilized on the borders of Poland, and that the Soviet government address the German working class and tell them, make your revolution, we are prepared to come to your aid with military support in the event the counter-revolution tries to arm itself and overthrow the workers' revolution. He says, you're not going to stop the war will be inevitable and take place under much more unfavorable conditions than it will now. Because now, with this sort of an appeal, there is a chance that the German working class can make its revolution, especially if they eliminate the factor of the possible intervention by imperialism to crush on the side of Hitler, like they did in Spain later. What lessons did the Comintern draw from the German experience? Now this, the third period, the last period for capitalism. It's a little pamphlet by Fritz Heckert, one of the top leaders of the German Communist Party, called What is Happening in Germany, published in June 1933. Hitler came into power in January 1933. This was published 2 months later and translated into English in June. I just want to quote you from the, I can't quote there, in the pamphlet itself, of course. The main blame was put on the social democracy. That was the burden. Trotsky, of course, came in for his usual dose of vilification. And the conclusion drawn was everything they had done was eminently correct. I just want to quote you from an official resolution of the Presidium of the Executive Committee of the Communist International, adopted April 1st, 1933. This is 4 months after Hitler had taken the power in Germany. Let me quote. Having heard the report of Comrade Heckert on the situation in Germany, the Presidium of the ECCI declares that the political line and the organizational policy pursued by the Central Committee of the Communist Party, led by Comrade Thälmann, before and at the time of the Hitler coup was quite correct. Mind you, the greatest, most catastrophic defeat suffered by the working class in the whole period following the First World War. The policy was eminently correct, both before and after. Now, you were saying something about how the Stalinists used quotations. What do I do with my kerchief? Did you take my kerchief out of my pocket? And of course, in explaining, they had to explain how could such a thing happen. In explaining it, of course, as is usual, with explaining every defeat experienced under their leadership, they had an appropriate quotation from Lenin. Say, the circumstances under which the proletariat in Germany functioned made it impossible for them to organize, and in fact failed to organize, an immediate and decisive blow against the state apparatus, which for the purpose of fighting against the proletariat absorbed the fighting organizations of the fascist bourgeoisie, the storm detachments, steel helmets, and the Reichswehr, and so forth and so on. The bourgeoisie was able, without serious resistance, to hand over the power of government in the country to the National Socialists, who acted against the working class by means of provocation, bloody terror, and political banditism, without serious resistance. Now, in analyzing the conditions for a victorious uprising of the proletariat, Lenin said, "A decisive battle can be considered as fully mature if all the class forces which are hostile to us have become sufficiently entangled, have sufficiently come into conflict with each other, have sufficiently weakened themselves by a struggle which is beyond their strength. If all the vacillating, hesitating, unstable, intermediate elements, that is, the petty bourgeoisie democracy as distinguished from the bourgeoisie, have sufficiently exposed themselves to the people, have sufficiently disgraced themselves by their practical bankruptcy. If, among the proletariat, mass sentiment has begun and is rising strongly in favor of supporting the most decisive, supremely bold and revolutionary activity against the bourgeoisie, then the revolution has matured. And if we have properly taken into account all of the conditions mentioned above and have properly selected the moment, our victory is assured, unquote. But it was precisely this was the lesson of the Third World Congress. It was precisely this that Lenin preached at the ultra-leftists, at the adventurists. And it's precisely this that they violated in the whole period prior to Hitler. So they turn everything upside down, you see. They take a polemic which Lenin had directed against the ultra-leftists and ultra-leftist policies such as they followed in Germany and use it to justify permitting the German capitalist class to come to power without a struggle because, you see, the revolutionary conditions hadn't matured. Let me continue, quote, they've got another quotation. Now that's the end of the Lenin quotation. Then they add, the characteristic feature of the circumstances at the time of the Hitler coup was that these conditions for a victorious rising had not yet managed to mature at that moment. They only existed in an embryonic state. As for the vanguard of the proletariat, the Communist Party, it did not wish to slip into adventurism, you see, and of course could not compensate for this missing factor by its own action. Then another quotation from Lenin. Quote, it is impossible to win with the vanguard alone, says Lenin. To throw the vanguard alone into the decisive fight, while the whole of the class, the whole of the broad masses, have not occupied the position either of direct support of the vanguard, or at least of friendly neutrality towards it, would not only be foolish, but a crime. End of quote. Such, they add, were the circumstances which decided the retreat of the working class and the victory of the party of the counter-revolutionary fascists in Germany. Mind you, Lenin again was preaching against the ultra-right, you cannot substitute the party for the class. If you attempt to do so, you'll be crushed. Therefore, it's necessary to apply the tactic of the United Front in order to win over the class in a whole epoch, in which, by partial struggles for elementary demands, defensive actions against the attack of the bourgeoisie and its fascist wing, that the workers will learn from these lessons, come over to the Communist Party, and you will have then a decisive section of the working class behind you. The very quotations that were used against their policy are used to justify their policy in Germany, including the one they say, the Communist Party was right in giving the name of social fascists to the Social Democrats. That was April 1933. 2 months later, another pamphlet, The Fight for Communism in Germany, which contained the program. It was issued by the Underground Communist Party of Germany as an important instrument in mobilizing the German working class for struggle against the bloody fascist dictator. Now, before I do, let's go back to Heckert for a minute. Heckert on Trotsky. I don't want you to think I'm concealing what Heckert had to say about Trotsky. The section is entitled Trotsky as Defender of the Social Democrats. The enormous treachery of a social democracy has called forth such a storm of indignation amongst the workers of all countries that other parties of the Second International have even decided to come forward in their defense. But the Social Democrats have found one ally, and this is Trotsky. As a political cipher in the working class movement, he has nothing to lose. He slobbers over the fascist boots, calculating that he can make people talk about him with the object of reappearing from his political oblivion for even one small hour at any price whatever. As a burglarious marauder, he creeps about where the blood of workers has been shed in order to ferret out some political quarry. Now, you got the picture? The working class in Germany have made bloody sacrifices. Hundreds of communists have been killed in Germany. Thousands of communists, among them the finest leader of the working class in Germany, Comrade Thälmann, are in prison. While the ally of Wells and Leipart, those are the leaders of the Social Democratic Party, Trotsky is intent on exculpating the Social Democrats in Germany from their responsibility for the seizure of power by the fascists and on placing the blame at the door of the commune. Now, what is it that called forth all this vituperation? Let me quote. In the Manchester Guardian of March 22nd, the social fascist Trotsky gave as the cause of the seizure of power by Hitler the fact that the Communist Party of Germany had not formed a united front with the Social Democratic Party on a platform exclusively acceptable to social democracy. And then they quote Trotsky, the platform, the defense of parliamentary government and the mass trade union. Now, what is wrong with that? Trotsky called for a united front, mind you, for the defense of parliamentary government and the mass trade union. That is elementary democratic demands at a time when Hitler had taken the power. This is after Hitler had taken the power, mind you, in January. And for this he was what? A burglarious marauder. Who was that? Vampire, yeah. A vampire seeking out workers' blood in order to fight. Okay. Let's see. He's a burglarious marauder and a social fascist. 2 months later, in their platform, their program, by the illegal German, what was left of it, calls for what? Quote, only a few days ago, the heads of the Communist International, as well as the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Germany, made their proposal of the United Front to the Executive Committee of the Second International, the heads of the Social Democratic Party, and the leaders of the German Federation of Labor for forcing through minimum anti-fascist demand. Mind you, for this, Trotsky was called a social fascist. Every epithet, every filthy slander that could be directed at him, precisely for this. He says, for a united front, it's got to be from the tops on down, from the Communist International to the Second International, from the German Communist Party to the Social Democratic Party, from every trade union, communist-controlled and social democratic, up and down the line, because these are struggles over the most elementary democratic demand, the right of the German working class to exist as an organized force. No. That was social fascism until June 1933. This logic these quotations about Lenin. It's the same sort of logic that was used by the young man who had murdered his father and mother and then pleaded for mercy on the grounds that he was an orphan. That's the kind of logic you had here. Is it surprising then the fact that there wasn't a single section in the entire Communist International that raised its voice in protest, demanding an explanation of how this terrible tragedy could happen? Is any wonder that Trotsky then said, "This organization is dead. Comintern is dead, and being dead, and being revolutionary internationalists, drew the only conclusion that could be drawn is necessary to begin the organization of the Fourth International, the International Revolutionary Socialism, to carry on the work begun by the First International, the first four congresses of the Third International, and which involves the very survival of mankind on a world scale."